Chapter 2. "My God, that was a damn good dinner," said Captain Aubrey, rather loud, as though he were addressing the masthead. He was not referring to his own meal with Sam, though that had been a capital feast of the naval style, ending with a truly sublime spotted dog, one at each end of the table, and improbable quantities of port. No, this was a physically far more gorgeous entertainment, a dinner given by the Governor in honour of His Excellency, the Most Reverend Dr. Samuel Maputa, he'd kept his mother's name, Papal Nuncio to the Republic of the Argentine, whose government he and his allies had undoubtedly saved very recently, when a numerous body of influential moderates, together with their black followers, had defected from those who were about to break out into open rebellion and had betrayed their arsenals. It was a dinner of high ceremony, served on gold plate of more than ordinary magnificence, with some particularly valued dishes, such as the River Plate lobster and a bitter chocolate sauce, and 70 of the finest guinea pigs ever brought down from the mountains. To be sure, it did lack something of the family atmosphere that had hovered in the frigate's great cabin, with every guest and servant aware of the relationship and wholly in favour of the young parson's seaman-like ways, to say nothing of his willingness to drink his wine. Here the connection, though not unnoticed, was much less obvious. Jack, being seated not indeed below the salt, but very much nearer to it than his son, at the very top, on the Governor's right hand. He uttered these fine, ringing words addressed to the nuncio, a little way below him, as he made his way cautiously down the palace steps, Killick and absurdly awkward Davies hovering at no great distance. Pitiless steps with no rail, very sharp edges, deep treads, and it was usual to make an inward promise of a fortnight's or even a month's pay to one's patron saint before embarking on them in the darkness. There were only 6 steps to go under the high-held torches when a small fat boy thrust his way through the crowd and called out, "Sir, oh, sir, if you please, the squadron's in the gut just stemming the tide." "Thank you, Mr. Wells," said Captain Aubrey, and craning his neck to peer in the direction of the gut, he missed his step and fell into His Excellency's waiting arms. Davy's prodigious strength supported the double burden. They recovered their balance, and Jack, walking along quite steadily, said, "Sam, I am so very happy. The squadron is down there in the gut stemming the tide. Even with this breeze, they'll be moored here off the island by slack water, and you'll see me go aboard. Now cut along, there's a good fella. You must get a decent night's sleep." A decent night's sleep. There weren't many people aboard the frigate who had the least expectation of such a thing. Surprise had 3 mastheads, and all were firmly occupied by the nimblest, most far-sighted young men on her books, quite irrespective of rank, and they called down every movement of their distant friends together with the even more portentous news of faintly discerned sails far down the immense estuary, conceivably the main squadron, under the orders of the Commander-in-Chief, South African Station, Lord Leighton. The surprise and her tender wringle would soon come under the very close, very knowing inspection of at least 1 senior flag officer, and of the less authoritative, but sometimes even more wounding scrutiny, of large numbers of officers, and above all of ratings. And there was nobody aboard either of the vessels who wished his own to be mocked, fleered at, or called a second-hand mudscow. They wanted no advice on cleanliness, seaman-like appearance, or the pridding of decks, no facetious observations about their attire. And even the watch below spent much of their precious sleeping time beautifying themselves and the ship. Perhaps the most active was Killick. Captain Aubrey had served as a commodore, so he already possessed a rear admiral's uniform. These garments had been a great source of joy to Killick, but an even greater source of anxiety. Termites in Malaysia, a shameless wombat in New South Wales, while from south of the Horn to the trackless wastes of the Pampas, innumerable forms of vermin had gnawed or attempted to gnaw the superfine broadcloth, or ruined the gold lace with their squalid dejections. During his anxious night, with so many of his shipmates scouring pistails or polishing musket cocks, begging valuable slush from the cook or, more fruitfully, from his mates, to give the round shots something of a gleam as they lay along in the garlands by the great guns, during this active time, he sat in the remarkably well-lit space where the surgeons often dissected their specimens or skinned their birds, sat there with Jack's best, rarely used sea chest open before him, half its contents spread out on a piece of sailcloth. His face was as pale as it could be, and expressed not only horror but anguish too, for this strong clear light showed that his zeal in earlier darker times had robbed the cloth of all its bloom. In places it was threadbare, and a heap of clothes had something of the sad abandoned air so evident in the second-hand barrows of Monmouth Street. "Pass the word for Killick," called a voice from the quarter-deck, and the cry was repeated until it echoed from the open chest itself. Automatically, the steward obeyed. "Sir," he said faintly to the towering captain, "have you laid out my number one uniform?" "Well, sir, in the manner of speaking," said Killick, "which it ain't what you might call weathered very well." Jack had never seen his steward so deeply moved. "Be damned to that," he said. "Every goddamn thing in that chest was frozen stiff week after week off the Horn. Just look out my ribbon of the bath, will you? It sets off an old coat very well." "Beg pardon, sir," said the officer of the watch. "Suffolk is launching a boat." Very true. Her barge was lowered down in a commendable fashion and manned. Her acting captain took his place by the midshipman in the stern. They pulled across with a particular accuracy of stroke, and the coxswain brought her kissing alongside with barely an impact. Captain Simmons came aboard nimbly in spite of his packet of letters. He saluted the quarter-deck and said, "Good morning, sir. I thought you'd like these," holding up the bundle, "as soon as possible." "Good morning, Simmons. Very good morning to you. How pleasant to see you again. You couldn't have judged better. We've had no news from home this many a day. Such a welcome packet. Thank you very much indeed." "Not at all, sir. Do you choose to come back in Suffolk's barge with your own coxswain?" "Thank you, Simmons. But I think I shall shift my clothes, look through the chief of these papers, and then come across at about four bells." At the fourth stroke, he ran down to the sadly weather-beaten boat, where his coxswain was already sitting in the bows with his precious burden. Ran down looking very grave. The red ribbon of his order shone in the light as he came aboard the Suffolk, but his face was as grave as ever. This was a profoundly serious occasion, and he scarcely smiled as Simmons presented his officers. The ceremony over, he nodded to his coxswain, standing there by the mizzen, and said, "Heave out the flag." The folded bundle soared aloft, followed with the utmost concentration by all hands. At exactly the right moment, the exact height to an inch, the coxswain snapped the tie, and the rear admiral's blue flag streamed out bravely in the wind, instantly greeted by the first of 13 solemn guns, salutes from all the members of the Blue Squadron, distant cheering from surprise, and clouds of wheeling, discontented gulls. "May I suggest a tour of the flagship, sir?" asked Simmons, with what cheerfulness he could muster. And together they paced along the decks, through the heady scent of powder, watched with discreet intensity by all who could decently do so, and by some who could not. "Tell me, Simmons," said Jack as they left the main magazine, walking delicately, as well they might with so many tons of gunpowder just behind them, "does the Admiral sail with a flag, Captain?"
"He did," said Simmons, embarrassed. "But Captain Fielding is going home with me if surprise can find room for us both."
"Ah," said Jack, aware that his question was untimely. "I only asked because I thought he might answer some of my less important questions. An admiral has plenty to do without being pestered. Perhaps I might turn to his secretary."
"I am afraid that would scarcely answer. Poor Coulter has been hauled over the coals before now for exceeding his office. It's very like what you and I knew aboard Pegasus."
"Oh, indeed." That had been a short, unhappy cruise when Jack was lent to the ship to take the place of her third lieutenant, shot through the head while attempting to board a Frenchman, Pegasus being a ship in which most people seemed to spend their time doing wrong. "Is not Suffolk somewhat short-handed?" he asked, partly to change the subject, but more to learn how a ship of the line could manage with so few people. The tween decks were scarcely populated. He didn't learn because the purser's clerk, an odd, long-legged, spectacled man devoured by curiosity, wished to find out who Captain Aubrey was, what he was doing here, and whether they would be able to water today or tomorrow. The great casks and hoses were all laid along, and as he uttered his almost mechanical questions, so he peered eagerly with his red-rimmed, short-sighted eyes into Captain Aubrey's face, apparently devoid of shame. By the time his appetite, his very considerable appetite, was satisfied, they'd forgotten the shortage of hands, and they walked on. It was a long inspection, and in the course of it, Jack met almost all his new officers again. A seaman-like set of men on the whole, and cautiously welcoming. One or two former shipmates known long ago. But he received a general impression of anxiety and overwork. An impression that was in part overlaid by his meeting with the gunner, the master gunner, among his 24-pounders, all as trim as heavy cannon could well be, and all equipped with shining Douglas sights. A long inspection, and by the end of it, when they stood there together in the bows, gazing out towards the approaching but still distant squadron, Jack had come to like his anxious, somewhat hag-ridden companion well enough to ask, "In really heavy weather, have you not found it difficult to work the ship with so small a company?"
"I have indeed. And I've heard of it, I do assure you."
He was cut short by a hail from the masthead, and a moment later the message came forward. The Rear Admiral was desired to go aboard the flag. "I'm afraid it'll be a wet pull," said Simmons. "May I lend you a tarpaulin jacket?"
"If you please," said Jack.
His fine but aged uniform had not much wear left in it, and he was a long, long way from home. A wet pull it was, through an increasingly choppy sea, right into the eye of the wind. It was, however, shortened by the zeal of the white and blue squadrons to reach a hospitable port.
"Well, Aubrey," said the Admiral, looking at him with a certain satisfaction,
You have had a wet time of it, I see. You should have put on an oilskin. Still, we cannot all be wise all the time. I've called you out so far from shore because there are two questions I should like to settle. The first is supplies. We're very low in everything. Tobacco is quite gone. And all the way down, my purser's agents and so on have had the utmost difficulty with the locals, even in ports where we've always been welcomed and entertained. Difficulties about water, difficulties about cattle, even about shore leave and common supplies. No bumboats coming off, no hauls. What's it like with you in Buenos Aires? Should I push on? Things are desperate low, and with the present ministry I dare not use force. How are things with you? My lord, until a few days ago we had great difficulty in getting supplies of any kind, but then an eminent ecclesiastic, a papal nuncio, particularly well known to my political adviser, Dr. Maturin. Yes, yes, Sir Joseph mentioned him to me. I shall pay him some attention. Came in, and now everything's settled. We lack for nothing, and prices are very moderate. We're amply stored for the Cape, and Surprise, which is now bound for home with my dispatches, is in much the same case. I'm heartily glad to hear of it. That'll be a very great relief. Lord Leighton uttered these words, but his aged yellow face didn't match them at all. His expression remained discontented, querulous, ready to find fault or to contradict. However, he did say, "Surprise." Yes, that reminds me. One of the reasons that I asked you to come out was to tell you that I intend to send two of my officers home, you know, and to ensure that there should be no trouble about taking them and an unsatisfactory midshipman aboard your vessel. You'll forgive me, my lord, but Surprise is no longer my vessel. To be sure, I did command her, but she was on hire to the Hydrographical Department of the Admiralty until I should meet your squadron, hoist my flag, and take up my new appointment. The moment I did that, Surprise's contract with the Admiralty came to an end. She returns to the sole ownership of a proprietor, a free agent. If you wish, I'll ask him whether he chooses to take these people aboard. But it is entirely at his discretion. He's at no man's command. "What a damned hair-spitting sea lawyer you are, upon my word, Aubrey," cried the Admiral. "You can damn well go back to that half-baked privateer in a donkey frigate and give the owner my orders to take these two officers and the reefer aboard. If he makes the slightest demur or objection, tell him that I shall press every man in his ship and leave him to wallow in the mud of the River Plate until she rots." At this point, the Admiral's yellow face had a curious flush, and his eyes fairly blazed. One clenched fist rose and fell. "The slightest demur or objection? Shall press every man?" repeated Jack, rising and drawing his tarpaulin round him. "Awkward, legalistic, cavilling sod," muttered the Admiral. And then, more audibly, as he rang for his steward, "Sit down. Sit down and drink some Madeira to the squadron supplies. And Fred," to the steward, "the decanter of Madeira from the coach and a couple of glasses." A pause. And he went on, "I do not like to ask a political adviser to come out in this blow. The doctor physicked Prince William, did he not? I'm told he's very well with his highness. But if you'll tell him that you've explained the situation, and that I shall take it as a personal favour, if he would allow these people to go aboard his ship, I should be obliged to you." "Very good, sir. Now, if I may, I shall carry your message to Dr. Maturin. If I were to take your purser and perhaps your secretary back with me to Surprise, my people could tell them all we know about our plentiful, plentiful sources of supply. The present governor is entirely on our side, and I don't think you'll be disappointed.
Make it so, Aubrey, said the Admiral, rising. And when you dine aboard me tomorrow, pray bring your political adviser. I should be happy to be acquainted with him and to offer what civilities I can. I presume he goes home in surprise. I cannot tell, my lord. His mission in Chile is clearly at an end, a most satisfactory end. But there may also be some duties waiting for him in South Africa and above all eastwards. He and Dr. Jacob are very knowing about those parts. But in any case, I mean to return to her at once and transfer some of her hands to poor thin Suffolk. Aye, it was the Yellow Jack off Port of Spain. And I shall carry your message. Your servant, my lord, and thank you for the capital Madeira. The pullback had the breeze and the sea right aft, and Jack went aboard surprised in fine style, the side dressed by smiling seamen and officers. He asked for the doctor, who, unused to the ceremonies attending a flag officer, was reading in the great cabin, reading his letters from home. Jack noticed his gravity, but delivered Lord Leighton's invitation and said, I shall be back in a few minutes. Please sort out my post and I shall join you. On deck, he gave the not unexpected order for all hands, and when the particularly attentive group was assembled, he said, Shipmates, as you know, the Barkey is going home. Some people are uneasy in their minds at being thrown ashore in peacetime. A general murmur of agreement, intense interest. Well, I can take 63 prime seamen over to Suffolk with me. Aboard her, it would, in course, be the same pay, rations and allowances as here, and in her you would find some officers you already know, and a score or two of former shipmates. So let them as choose to serve on the South African station. Ask my clerk to set their names down on a list, and I shall mark those I think best suited for the climate. A general buzz of strong approval, not quite a cheer, out of respect for the flag officer, and Rear Admiral Aubrey plunged below, where Stephen looked up with a frown, pushing Jack's heap towards him, and silently going on with his own. Sophie Aubrey had almost all the virtues of a woman who had had the meagre education of her class, taught by a singularly ignorant governess, little beyond the 3 hours and a smattering of French, together with a list of good and bad kings. She had never been encouraged to read, and in fact she'd read very little. But she could and did write a singularly beautiful hand. Her piano playing was purely mechanical, yet then again she had naturally pretty manners. She was tall and slim, her complexion was quite admirable, and she moved with a perfect unconscious grace. It was a delight to see her going down the dance. But she was an indifferent, unwilling horsewoman, in spite of arduous, dreaded lessons in her youth and her husband's kindly meant encouragement. And she'd never learnt to date her letters. Jack's bundle hadn't come aboard arranged in order of time, and although from a few hints thrown out by chance, gifts of partridges, the flowering of certain shrubs, children's holidays, birthday feasts, he slowly imposed a remote hint of sequence, he could scarcely confide in it at all. He did make out that his valuable agent was managing his more distant estate, the inherited Rottenborough that gave him a seat in Parliament remarkably well, that the Woolcombe land was more prosperous than ever it had been, and that, generally speaking, the children's health, apart from the usual coughs, colds, and one green stick fracture, was all that could be wished. The pattern, the history of all that these many letters told, was still very far from clear,
but the hint of discord and unhappiness that he'd acquired from the first random pages, and that he'd carried with an anxious mind to the Suffolk, the hint that had much increased the gravity of that ceremony, now expanded to a conscious and reasoned certainty. There had indeed been grave unhappiness at Woolcombe, and in all likelihood the unhappiness was still there. From time to time he glanced over at Stephen, who was equally grave, but whose letters, whose dated and indeed numbered letters, for from early childhood Christine had been brought up to keep exact ornithological and botanical records, were now assembled in neatly ordered piles, that he was at present annotating in a private script, just as he would have annotated any other body of intelligence documents. From time to time, Stephen felt his friend's gaze heavy upon him, but this was an exceedingly delicate affair, with very strong emotions involved, and he didn't choose to broach a subject that concerned Jack even more than it concerned him. Still less did he wish to force the confidence. He therefore made no observation of any kind until Jack turned and said, "Brother, I'm most uncommon stupid today, what with the emotion of hoisting my flag. Hoisting my flag, God bless us all! And having a set-to with Lord Leighton, as well as coping with our people. And I cannot make head or tail of what's afoot at home, except that they don't seem to be quite friends. Have you puzzled it out? I mean, if you've had the same kind of letters." "I believe I have, my dear, though I may well be mistaken. You'll recall that Christine went down to Woolcombe at my particular request, and at dear Sophie's invitation." "Yes, yes, I remember it perfectly. At that time, your twin daughters were away at their aunt's school in Ulster." "Just so. They travelled with James Callaghan, whose eldest girl is there too. So at Woolcombe there was just Sophie, your young George on long leave while his ship was refitting, Christine Wood, and my Bridget. Edward Heatherley had brought them down from the North Country, but at that point he didn't stay, having at least three papers to read before the Society. All this while we were moving slowly towards Brazil." Stephen nodded and went on, "Perhaps I told you that among a quantity of letters that I received at Funchal, there was a note from Edward speaking of his delight in the countryside about Woolcombe and his hope of hunting there one day?" "I believe you did. Do you think a pot of coffee would sharpen my wits?" He touched the bell. "You'll take a cup, I'm sure." Stephen agreed and went on, "That was the posture of affairs. A very elegant posture, too, with George and Bridget, excellent good friends, often riding on a stout, well-boned pony, the source, alas, of that green stick fracture. It knit very soon, and it earned him another 3 months' leave, to be sure. And this was the state of affairs when Edward came back from London. He'd been charmed by the reception of his papers, and he was even more charmed by the countryside. He thought it ideal for fishing, for hunting fox or hare, and for recording the movements, mating, nesting and diet of an extraordinarily large number of birds. And he asserted that he should start making inquiries for a house to be let or sold, observing that although their place in the north was very well, the weather was exceptionally and increasingly severe, which his declining health could no longer endure. So Sophie, judging very rightly from his carriage, servants and evident style of living, suggested a comfortable, fair-sized house a quarter of a mile away. Medenham. Just so. Which had been empty for some time, but which, with a garden and meadows, had been carefully kept up, and which was to be had at a modest rent by a tenant such as Mr. Heatherley, and if dear Christine liked, she would ask the agent for an order to view. The brother and sister viewed with every intention of being pleased, and they came away delighted. Indeed, they would have been difficult to satisfy if they hadn't liked Medenham, a warm, comfortable, spacious, low-built house of Charles II's time, with linen cupboards fit to shelter a troop of horses, massive furniture of another age, and a considerable library mostly of travel and natural philosophy. The affair was soon concluded. Necessaries and a few servants were sent down from the north, and the new tenants moved in. The nearby families soon paid their visits, and Mr. Heatherley and his sister were pronounced a great acquisition to the neighbourhood, particularly as Mr. Heatherley spoke eagerly of his intention to hunt that year. This, however, proved a hope not easily realised. The horses were soon in the stalls, a handsome bay mare and two promising grey geldings, but Mr. Heatherley had a troublesome neighbour in the north who coveted his estate. And when it was refused to be sold, this man turned to the exceedingly complex law governing mineral deposits in those parts, which, he contended, gave him the right, in the peculiar jurisdiction of the province, to pursue an uninterrupted vein under the adjoining land, under Edward Heatherley's land. Before Michaelmas, therefore, the poor man climbed into his coach again and travelled northwards to his bitter moors through the driving rain, to spend all his diminishing energy in lawyers' meetings and vain attempts at understanding counsel's opinions on the most profoundly obscure customary laws of usage where minerals were concerned in that particular district. During this period, Christine spent much of her time at Woolcombe, and so, except for those necessary hours in the schoolroom with her new governess, the capable and intelligent Miss West, did Bridget, walking in and out as though it were her own home, often accompanied by her companion George, who sometimes improved his indifferent mathematics with Miss West, and sometimes showed both governess and pupil the higher flights of knotting. It was during the later part of this season, when field mushrooms were to be had by the basketful for the picking, that the little household began to look for the return of Mr. Edward. He'd uttered some general remarks about having a wheel retired and the horses shod, when a carriage was heard coming up the drive. For a few moments those who were drinking tea in the small drawing-room thought it might possibly be Mr. Edward's coach, sounding soft because of the rain. But not at all. It was a common postchaise bringing the twins earlier than usual, not at all uncommon with Sophie's sister, who would seize upon any conveyance, any travelling companion, to send her pupils home. The letters that described this homecoming varied. But Stephen, who knew those concerned extremely well, saw the Aubrey girls hurrying in, tired, cross and hungry, intensely jealous at seeing Bridget sitting there by their mother, warm, prettily dressed and well fed. "Are you still here?" asked Charlotte. "You're always here," cried Fanny. And there was some motion towards pushing her off the sofa, strongly repelled by George. Clearly Sophie and Christine dealt with the situation. The clack and din of the accompanying County Armagh maidservant was a great help. And the Aubrey girls were taken away, washed and fed, while Christine led Bridget home, desiring Padine to carry the twins' trunk indoors and settle with the postillion. "As I see it, dear Jack," said Stephen, "the twins' jealousy, exacerbated by the weariness of travelling, extreme hunger and the hot squalor of a post-chaise, exploded into open violence when they saw Bridget there, brushed and in a handsome garment, sitting in the most favoured place next to their mother. A good night's sleep, a body bath of warm water, fresh clothes and a substantial breakfast is likely to restore all their amiability." "I'm sure you're right," said Jack. But he didn't believe it. He knew far better than Stephen that there was little amiability to restore. Not from the beginning, when the little girls were virtually one being, but quite early he had seen this jealousy directed by a mutual common understanding against any person, any creature even, for whom their gentle and affectionate mother showed a particular liking. Their father, being a sort of household god, was exempt, and so were some of the minor animals. But not George, who was accused of siding with Bridget against them, and of running after her like a little dog. It was an unhappy state of affairs. Above all, that Edward Heatherly was away in the north, and that in his absence Christine was staying at Woolhampton, where her support for Bridget increased the atmosphere of ill will. "Sometimes I count the remaining days of holiday on the calendar," wrote Sophie. "They seem to stretch on and on. And I'm so afraid that Christine and I may quarrel. Sometimes I see her check the angry words when the twins are particularly unkind. And rather than have that, I'm minded to suggest that she and Padeen should travel up to the north to stay with dear Edward, at least until the girls go back to school. I know that she's particularly anxious to escape the attentions, the very pronounced attentions of Captain Miller." "I don't think I know about Captain Miller," said Stephen. "What is his ship?" "Oh, no, he's only a soldier," said Jack. "He has a moderate estate the other side of Caxley. A surprising number of pheasants. But a sad coxcomb, I fear. I only say how do you do when we meet. A soldier. His regiment was posted to Sierra Leone at one time." "Oh, that'll be the Admiral," he said, breaking off as the salute began, doubled and redoubled by echoes and by the Citadel's prodigious reply to latent civility. "The Admiral's at hand," said Jack in the flattened silence. "And I should have told you before that he begs the favour of passage home for his flag captain and another unfortunate whose name I forget. And I rather think, brother, that I've pledged your word in exchange for the moving of 60-odd prime hands to Suffolk, which can hardly win her anchors else. Oh, they were so happy when—" "Whittles is up," said Killick, and the scent of toasted cheese wafted in with him. They ate in silence, intently, hungrily, and then resting his fork, Jack said, "I've had what I think is an idea worthy of Newton. But during the night I must spend the rest of my time reading the rest of my debtors. And unless they contradict me, I shall tell you at breakfast. For once that's eaten, surprise must make sail."